Finally? Clive asked. My storage space power. It equips anything I summon with iron rank magic equipment, but I didn't have a summoning ability. My mother kept telling me it would come, but it's a relief it finally has. Spartoi, Jason said. That's unexpected. You've heard of them? Humphrey asked. They're part of a myth from my world, Jason said. Oddly enough, about a guy named Jason. He was on a quest, and to complete it, he needed to pass these trials set by a king. One of the trials was to sow dragon's teeth, and a bunch of soldiers sprung up. He threw a rock at one of them, and they got confused and killed one another. Was he the person you were named after? No, Jason said darkly. I was named after a footy player. I guess you just hope no one throws a rock at them, Clive said. Want to try summoning them now? I'll wait until we're outdoors, Humphrey said. I want to see what Jason gets. Yes, Clive said, turning enthusiastically to Jason. The No Ritual Awakening. I've been looking forward to this. It's really not that exciting, Jason said. Let me clean this up first. He took a cleaning cloth and some alchemical solution from the ritual room supply cabinet and wiped the residue of the magical circle off the smoothly polished stone floor. Now, Clive said eagerly, as Jason put the cleaning supplies away. Jason shook his head, taking out the awakening stone. It glowed with a white gold light, like a holy object. Item, awakening stone of absolution, unranked, epic. An awakening stone containing the power of redemption. Consumable, awakening stone. Requirements, unawakened essence ability. Effect, awakens an essence ability. You have 5 unawakened essence abilities. You are able to absorb awakening stone of absolution. Absorb, yes, no. The stone vanished into Jason's hand, and his eyes started shining with golden light, which darkened until they were black orbs, before returning to normal. You have awakened the Doom Essence ability, Blade of Doom. You have awakened 3 of 5 Doom Essence abilities. Ability, Blade of Doom, Doom. Conjuration, Unholy. Cost, Moderate Mana. Cooldown, None. Current rank, Iron, 0.00%. Effect, Iron. Conjures, Ruin, the Blade of Tribulation. Attacks made with Ruin will inflict an instance of Vulnerable, and refresh any wounding effects on the target. Wounding effects refreshed by Ruin require more healing than normal to negate. Ruin is an unholy object. Vulnerable, affliction, unholy, stacking. All resistances are reduced. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Consumed to cleanse instances of resistant on a 1-to-1 basis. The others were in Jason's party and could see his ability description. They were all quiet for a moment as they looked at it. Jason? Humphrey asked, breaking the silence. Yes, Humphrey? Jason asked. That was an awakening stone of absolution, Humphrey said. Yes, it was, Jason said. Didn't it say something about containing the power of redemption? I think it did, yes, Jason said. And it gave you the power to conjure a cursed weapon, Humphrey said. Strictly speaking, Clive said, it's unholy, not cursed. My mistake, Humphrey said. You use the power of redemption to create an unholy weapon.
It does look like that, yeah.
How did you manage that exactly? I'm not entirely sure. I don't want to go accusing anyone of being evil.
Very fair.
I feel compelled to ask, though, Humphrey said. Jason, are you evil?
I think everyone has dark urges, Jason said defensively.
Yes, but not everyone has the Blade of Doom. I only had unawakened ability slots from the Dark and Doom essences. It would be a bit odd if I could conjure the Wand of Sunshine and Rainbows.
Jason held out his hand, and an elaborate dagger appeared in it, made of black obsidian and blood-red crystal. The blade was jagged, slightly curved, and the single most sinister object he had ever seen.
"How did you get that?" Humphrey asked. "The Awakening Stone was absolution."
"Well," Jason said, turning the knife over in his hand, "I'm absolutely going to mess up some monsters with it."
Chapter 89 Anti-Pirate Operations. Cassandra Mercer awoke to the sound of crockery and cutlery being laid out in the next room. She swung her legs out of bed and got up, stretching. She didn't want to put on fresh clothes before she had a shower, so she put on the only article of clothing she could see at a glance, Jason's shirt she had tossed aside the night before. She stepped out onto the balcony to look out on the Guild District street, busy with early morning traffic. Her normal routine was to start the day with physical training, but with the sand barge expedition, she would get exercise enough.
"Morning," Jason said, carrying a large tray onto the balcony. He paused to take in the sight of her leaning against the balcony rail in his shirt. Her delicate features were fresh-faced, despite having just woken up. Her long, dark hair was slightly mussed, which somehow was all the more appealing. A pair of toned, athletic legs emerged from the bottom of his shirt. She turned to give him an inquisitive look, and he set out breakfast on the table under the shade awning.
"This is what you look like first thing in the morning?" he asked unhappily as they sat.
"You realize the rest of us don't look that good even when we try our best."
"I didn't hear you get up," she said, ignoring his question. "Are you an expert at sneaking out of bed in the morning?"
"Breakfast the next morning is my signature move," Jason said. "It's how I convince people they haven't made a horrible mistake."
He started lifting the covers off the trays he had laid out on the table, introducing them one by one. Scrambled eggs, hash brown nests, stewed apple oatmeal, cream cheese pancake balls with butter and syrup. She picked out a pancake ball and bit into it. Her little moan of pleasure crawled into Jason's ear and gave his hindbrain a coquettish wave.
"Just keep bringing the pleasure?" she asked.
"That's the basic idea."
"And how many people have you tried this signature move on exactly?"
she asked, teasingly.
"Am I not the first girl to visit the Asano lodgings?"
"You're the first woman," he said. "Girls don't interest me." She let out a low, sultry laugh.
"You really are good at people, aren't you?"
"I have my moments."
"How about back in your world?"
"Nothing you haven't heard before," Jason said. Heart-shattering first love, followed by a series of empty, self-pitying encounters. A few real relationships here and there, but I didn't leave anyone behind, if that's what you're asking. She smiled, finishing off the pancake ball and reaching for one of the hash brown nests. He poured two glasses of spiced milk from a pitcher. They took to the food, conversing in glances as they ate.
"You're not going to ask after my sordid past?"
"You're here now," Jason said. "I don't see how the rest matters." She tilted her head, considering him, curiously.
"I'm still trying to unravel you, Jason Asano."
"I'm not going anywhere," Jason said. He glanced at the clock on the wall. "Actually, not true," he said. "We have to be at the marshalling yard in about an hour and a half. I should jump in the shower."
"Oh," she said with a smile. "I think we can figure out something much better to do in the shower than jump."
The Adventure Society campus was only a short walk from Jason's lodgings, so they walked in the late morning sunshine. She had her adventuring gear in her storage space, so she didn't need to detour home. There were around 2 dozen people assembled for the expedition, and they were not the last to appear. Their arrival at the marshalling yard together did not go unnoticed. Cassandra went off to speak with friends, while Jason headed for a clump of gellers. Cassandra's gently brushing over his arm as they parted likewise caught the attention of prying eyes. Jason walked across the marshalling yard, under the unhappy glare of several young men. He felt several bronze rank auras press rudely down on him, but ignored them as he greeted Humphrey, Phoebe, and Gabrielle, the acolyte of knowledge. Others he recognized from his time in the Mirage Arena.
"I think you just made a lot of enemies," Phoebe said. "Do you know how many of the bronze rankers have designs on her?"
"You can't live your life afraid of who won't like you," Jason said.
Speaking of which, Rick Geller and his team joined. They exchanged greetings, although the healer, Claire, gave Jason a spiteful look. Her twin, Hannah, cast a gaze in the direction of Cassandra Mercer, who was chatting with her own friends. Cassandra glanced their way, eyes twinkling, then turned back to her own group. The big man, Jonah, had squared himself in front of Jason.
I have to admit, Jonah said, you can fight. You know we would have pasted you in seconds on open ground, though, right?
That's hardly an incentive to fight on open ground, then, is it? Jason asked.
Jonah let out a boisterous laugh, slapping Jason on the shoulder.
That's a pretty good point, Jonah acknowledged.
How do you think you'll do on open sand, though? Sand pirates sound like a lot more fun than yet another bog monster, but it doesn't seem like your kind of terrain.
Oh, I imagine I'll muddle through, Jason said.
Jason took out two skimmers full of them, Humphrey said.
I took one, Jason said. My familiar took the other. I was pretty pleased with myself until I saw the aftermath of what Humphrey did. He halfway buried a skimmer with the pirates still in it. One swing of his sword.
Everyone will get their chance today, Ernest Geller said, approaching the group. He had been in charge of their expedition when they first encountered the sand pirates, but today he was just one of the crowd. There were a couple of other bronze rank family members with him as they joined the assembled Gellers and exchanged greetings.
Hey, it's Mose, Jason said, spotting another member of their last expedition. He's with his cousin. I might go say g'day.
You know Beth Cavendish? Humphrey asked.
We've met, Jason said. You know her?
When people talk about the potential of Iron Rankers, Phoebe said, she's the reason Humphrey comes in at number two. She leads her own team, all locals, unlike us.
Good to know, Jason said, heading over. I'll say g'day for you too, Humphrey.
The huge expedition had more than 40 people. They were divided into teams of 6 Iron Rankers, plus 1 Bronze Ranker per team. Leading the expedition was a Silver Ranker, an elf from the Cavendish family, plus Vincent as the Adventure Society representative. Once the groups were organized, the plan was explained. What they had been calling the Sand Pirates after their attack on the Spirit Coin Convoy were actually the Ustai tribe, a group of nomads from a region to the north. The expedition was a show of strength to bring the tribe into negotiations. The best outcome was to peacefully convince the Ustai to either return north or agree not to attack any further Spirit Coin convoys. Failing that, they were to be captured by force and brought to the city for interrogation on what had brought them south in the first place. A train of magically powered carriages took the expedition to the edge of the delta, where each team boarded one of a half dozen prepared sand skimmers. Jason spotted Clive. He had been tapped as one of the skimmer pilots for another team. Jason was placed in a group with the 4 members of Beth Cavendish's team, plus her cousin, Mose. Leading them was a bronze ranker Jason didn't know, but guessed to be from one of the lesser families in Greenstone. He was only 20 or 21, and was eager to defer to Beth. One of the members of Beth's team was a huge human named Hudson. He looked like Humphrey, with 20% bonus person, to the point of being almost as large as Gary. They boarded their skimmer and set off. They sailed over the sand, rushing through the scorched desert air. Jason noticed the huge man looking at him.
"Something I can help you with?" Jason asked him.
"Aren't you that guy with the evil powers?" Hudson asked. "The one from the recording?"
Jason sighed.
"That's me." "You don't seem evil," Hudson told him.
"Then you have to ask yourself," Jason said. "Was I pretending to be evil then, or am I pretending to not be evil now?"
"Which is it? Finding out would probably cost you more than you're willing to pay," said Nico, another member of Beth's team.
Nico was a smolder, a race Jason had only met a few of. They had dark skin, glowing red eyes, and jet black hair. All he really knew about them was that they had powerful earth and fire affinities, and that in spite of their sinister appearance, the few he had met were quite easygoing. The skimmers paused to meet up with an adventurer assigned to keep track of the Ustai sand barge. He was a bronze ranker with sand essence, completely at home out in the desert. He could move over the sands faster than a skimmer.
As instructed, I didn't hide that I was watching them, the adventurer told the expedition leader. They tried chasing me off a few times, but didn't have anyone that could outpace me.
Any indication they'd be willing to talk to us, or do you think they'll attack on sight? The expedition leader asked.
Well, they might have been chasing me out of the desperate desire to have a nice chat, the adventurer said. I didn't stick around to find out.
From what we know of the Ustai, Vincent said, so long as we show strength, they should be willing to talk.
I wouldn't go into this expecting to come out unbloodied, the expedition leader said.
All we can do is our best, Vincent said.
A ballista bolt from the sand barge penetrated the canvas canopy on the sand skimmer, pinning most to the base.
Negotiations went badly, it seems, Nico said, pulling the bolt out of Mos.
Blood came with it, but Beth was already chanting a spell.
Let the waters make whole that which has come to harm.
Water appeared in front of Mos, flowing into the wound. It washed away the blood to reveal clean, repaired skin. The skimmer came to a stop, and Hudson jumped out. The big man knelt on the ground, both palms flat in the sand. Suddenly a wall surged out of the sand to shield them from any further attacks.
This is our regroup point, Beth said. If you get turned around or isolated, or the fight goes badly, get back here. Otherwise, everyone use Jason's ability to stay in contact.
With Jason's new party interface ability, the group could stay in voice contact, even in the midst of battle.
We're going to move on the sand barge, Beth directed,
completely disregarding their bronze rancor.
Hudson front and center, Emily and Nico flank, me and Mose in the middle. Jason, you're our roaming scout. If there's any group looking organized and heading in our direction, warn us and sow some chaos. Is that something you can handle?
Yes, ma'am.
Beth turned to the bronze ranker.
You, Clarence, was it?
Terence, the man said.
You bring up the rear and keep a clear extraction path, Beth instructed. Losing is acceptable. Failing to escape is not.
They moved around the wall, the huge body of Hudson in the lead. As he moved, his body transformed from flesh to sandstone, which didn't slow him down at all. All around them, the other skimmers had come to a stop, and the groups were moving on the sand barge, which had likewise pulled to a halt. People poured off it by the dozen, charging wildly as they raised their weapons in the air. Jason noticed some of the groups on his side were more organized than others. The two groups made up mostly of Gellers were moving in formation, much like Beth's team. Others seemed no better organized than the whooping Ustai charging in their direction. These less controlled adventurers were already launching arrows, spears, and bolts of magic, to limited effect while the groups were still at a distance. Behind the charging Ustai, small but fast-firing ballistae were going to work. A bolt came sailing out of the air, only to be intercepted by an arrow shot by Emily, the archer from Beth's team. She was a Celestine, with fair skin and golden eyes that matched her pixie-cut hair. She easily picked out the approaching bolt and fired an arrow that exploded on contact.
You are in the area of an ally's invincible aura. You have increased damage reduction against normal and iron rank damage sources. You are in the area of an ally's lifebringer aura. You recover health over time, and healing abilities used on you are more effective.
Jason unleashed his own aura as his cloak of night appeared around him. Looking ahead, Ustai were charging at them in clusters.
Watch your balance,
Hudson warned, and a large flat block of sandstone rose from the sand under the team's feet. It started carrying them forwards like a quick-moving raft. Jason looked forwards to the Ustai drawing closer.
Sow some chaos, yeah? He said to Beth.
If you're up to it, she said.
I'll take a gander and see what I can do.
He took one of the throwing needles from the bandolier on his chest, one identified by a black cord. He pulled his arm back and tossed it in a long arc to land amongst the Ustai, engulfing a patch of them in a sphere of shadow. Jason stepped into Beth's shadow, falling through it like it was a hole in the ground. Shortly after, the group heard screaming mixed into the battle cries of the Ustai. Chapter 90 The Path to Bronze. The sphere of shadows was short-lived, but Jason made the most of it as he danced among the blinded Ustai.
special attack, leech bite, has inflicted bleeding on Astai warrior. Weapon, ruin, has inflicted vulnerable on Astai warrior. Weapon, ruin, has refreshed bleeding on Astai warrior. Bleeding will absorb more healing before being negated. His cloak and rapid teleportation made him impossible to pin down, even as the shadows faded. By the time they finally got a good look at his shadowy form, Beth and her team were crashing into the scattered cluster of Astai. Some had fallen to slit throats or a dagger to the back of the neck, while others had poisoned blood streaming from non-lethal wounds. Some had no wounds at all, yet were bleeding from the eyes and nose from Jason's hemorrhage spell. Only a fraction of the Astai warriors were iron rankers, with most having only one or two essences, if that. The results of clashing with a small army of adventurers were very bad for the nomads. Despite their numerical disadvantage, even the least capable adventurer teams were carving a path through the enemy. Most of the teams had a bronze ranker at the front, cutting down sand pirates like wheat in a field. Only as the adventurers neared the sand barge did the bronze rank Astai captains go out to meet them. Beth had her team's bronze ranker at the back, but she didn't call him up as an Astai captain bore down on them. The stone raft they had been riding on sank back into the ground. It was replaced by a smaller block under the feet of Hudson, the huge man with the sandstone body. It carried him forwards as a stone shield appeared in his hands, while the Astai captain launched into some kind of charging special attack. The captain's bronze rank charging power shattered the stone shield and sent Hudson staggering back. The captain's own momentum was halted, however, and iron chains whipped up out of the sands to ensnare him. The chains started burning red hot, causing the captain to scream with rage. An arrow with a glowing head struck him and exploded. He surged forward, wrenching himself out of the chains. Hudson, recovered from their initial clash, lunged forwards as a huge stone hammer appeared in his hands for a powerful downward swing. The captain met the hammer with an upward swing of his large axe, shattering the hammer into shards. He turned his gaze on Hudson, oblivious that the razor-sharp shards had not fallen to the ground, but instead were floating in the air. Realization came when the sharp fragments shot in, slicing at his body. The captain was on the back foot, and Beth's team pressed hard, unleashing a barrage of attacks. Nico conjured an iron harpoon with a chain on the end, throwing it at the captain, who deflected it with a bare hand. Other team members unleashed arrows charged with energy and magic bolts of fire and wind. Beth cast a spell that fired a thin jet of water, cutting like a bandsaw. The Astai captain fell under the onslaught, and the group reached the barge, alongside several other teams. The sand barge was a terrifying edifice. First was the size, easily the equal of a passenger liner from Jason's own world. Jason had heard the entire Astai tribe lived in it, and seeing it for himself had no doubt it was true. After the sheer size, the next thing to be noticed were the giant bones that made up the basic structure. It looked like many leviathan creatures had their skeletons taken apart and reassembled as the framework of the vessel. Three giant skulls, each the size of a house, adorned the flat-nosed bow. The result was like a giant, undead chimera stalking the desert. The structure was akin to a passenger ferry, with multiple decks towering up into the air. Ramps had opened up in the side to disgorge the Astai, and were still doing so as the adventurer teams approached. Emily, the archer of Beth's team, fired an arrow that duplicated itself over and over as it sailed through the air. One became two, two became four, four became eight. It happened over and over in the short time the arrow was in flight, until a storm of arrows rained down on the closest of the ramps. Astai fell away, those waiting inside given pause as their fellows dropped away. Hudson ploughed up the ramp, crashing into the people inside and making space for the others. They weren't the first to board. Other teams had made similar progress with other ramps, and Jason had noted the silver rank expedition leader simply leapt through the air onto an upper deck. Jason followed Beth's team onto the lower decks, where he could make his home in the shadows. Once on board, things quickly devolved into a chaotic melee. The caliber of each Adventure Society team quickly became apparent. Beth and Rick Geller's groups were both built around permanent teams, and the experience of working together became clear as their formations held, the whole stronger than the sum of the parts. Other teams were quickly swept up in the chaos. Even Humphrey's group, made up of strong individual members but not a fixed team, had their formation split up. As for the less elite teams, the smaller confines started costing them casualties. Jason's power made him freely mobile, and he didn't gel with Beth's team, who were used to one another. Unneeded as part of the formation, Jason gave Beth a heads up as he moved to try and help the more overwhelmed individuals. Colin proved to be an absolute menace after Jason sprayed him out over a crowd of Ustai. Jason instructed the leeches to go wild, knowing they shared his understanding of who was friend or foe. He suspected the occasional ally would suffer a nibble, but trusted Team Colin to largely stay on task. Jason himself used a hit-and-run approach, doing his best to alleviate the pressure on other adventurers. Harassment and disruption were the goals. He was more interested in turning an ally's fight than finishing it for them. He did land lethal blows when he could, but was satisfied with a savagely bleeding wound. Timed well, another adventurer could use the distraction to finish the job. Auras were running wild through the barge, making it hard to pick out the rare iron rankers among the teeming Ustai. When he found one, he would pounce, leaving a full suite of afflictions before moving on. More and more, he found people who had suffered the attentions of Colin, prompting him to find a dark space from which to cast a spell. His cloak hid him away, while there was more than enough noise to mask a quiet chant.
"Suffer the cost of your transgressions."
His punition spell dealt instant damage for every affliction Colin had left on the victim. There was no indication of the spell other than the effect it produced, which startled the surrounding Ustai as one after another of their number withered and died without any apparent cause. Other times he would instead use his Feast of Absolution spell to replenish his stamina and mana. The stream of energy flowing from an enemy into his hand gave away his position, but having just been topped off, he could teleport away freely, leaving confused enemies in his wake. The adventurers slowly but surely gained control of the bottom deck. The bronze rank Ustai captains held the various stairways leading up as they commanded the tribesmen to retreat up them. The bronze rank adventurers regrouped their teams that had been scattered in the melee. There had been a few casualties, but most were still alive and the healers went to work. Jason took the chance to gather up Colin, although many of the leeches were carried upstairs by the Ustai.
"Good work, team," Jason told the leeches as he crouched down for them to enter a cut on the back of his hand.
As he did so, the bronze rankers gathered to discuss the next push.
"It's going to be hard to establish a position on the higher decks," Ernest Geller said. With the silver-ranked expedition leader somewhere in the upper decks, he asserted control of the gathered forces.
"Gather all our bronze rankers and force passage up one of the stairways and push through from there," he said.
The other bronze rankers agreed. There was no strict chain of command, but Ernest's confidence brought the others into line. A team was assigned to watch their backs for an Ustai counterstrike from the other stairwells. Then the attack on the next deck began. The tribesmen still had the numbers, but the essence disparity was the defining factor, and the deck was soon wet with Ustai blood. After the organized surge up the chosen stairwell, the team spread out from their foothold on the next level, and things once again became chaotic. Jason spotted one of the weaker teams that had managed to stick together but were being hemmed in by Ustai. Their bronze rank team leader went down, taking an Ustai captain with her. One of the iron rankers took charge.
"Everyone use your coins!"
he shouted out, and Jason watched them all slip silver coins into their mouths. "Oh, crap," Jason muttered, looking around. He spotted Humphrey's team through the wild melee and teleported over, arriving in front of their team leader, Ernest. The Gellers knew his cloak well, but Jason still pushed back the hood to prevent friendly fire.
"I just saw a team lose their leader and wolf down silver coins," he said. "They're going to need an extraction."
"Idiots," Ernest said.
"Point the way."
Jason did, sticking with Ernest's team as they fought their way forward.
"You're right," Humphrey asked Jason as they pushed forward.
"It's a grim job," Jason said, Humphrey nodding his agreement.
They were closing in on the other team. Their burst of silver rank power had overwhelmed the Ustai around them, but that fleeting strength was giving way to weakness as the power of the coins left them. Seeing their enemy's flag, the Ustai pushed harder, but reinforcements arrived for the weakened adventurers in the nick of time. Humphrey exploded into the Ustai like a cannonball, a single sweeping stroke cutting three of them clean in half at the waist. His team capitalized on the momentum to surge into the tribesmen. Jason appeared behind the largest cluster, once again unleashing a spray of Colin. The adventurers took control, Humphrey's team surrounding the coin-weakened adventurers. Their healer was going to work on the fallen team leader, who was badly hurt. An iron rank healer wasn't enough to get a severely injured bronze ranker immediately back into the action.
"We'll get them out," Ernest told Jason. "You go back to making a mess."
Jason nodded, flicking his hood back up. Eventually, the adventurers claimed full control of the Great Sand Barge. While the main force was fighting below, the expedition leader had leapt straight to the upper decks. After crashing his way through the Astai leadership, he confronted the only silver ranker they had, their tribal chief. Demonstrating the difference between a fully trained adventurer and a nomad, the battle between silver rankers was punishingly one-sided. After the clan chief fell, the surviving Astai leadership gave up. It took time to filter down to the decks of the sand barge as fighting continued, but the now decimated Astai tribe surrendered. Jason was glad he had no part of the post-battle organization. Imprisoning the Astai in their own barge was a logistical nightmare, especially with some of what they found on board. The tribe's women and children had been locked away like slaves, which was borne out when they found actual slaves in essentially the same conditions. Waiting around with the other iron rankers not yet roped into assisting, he sat down to meditate in the shade of the sandstone wall Hudson had made in the beginning. The battle had been long, wild, and quite unlike anything he had experienced. Rather than carefully choosing his moments, he had been flickering through the battle, seizing chances as he found them. His familiar proved incredibly powerful, and Jason's abilities saw plenty of use. He had even taken the chance to use his new spells as much as he could. Humphrey found him, saw him meditating, and sat down to do the same. The battle was as new an experience for him as it was for Jason, and he had his own insights to consolidate. Beth's team spotted them as they returned, the wall being their team's regrouping point. They looked at Jason and Humphrey, sitting cross-legged in the sand.
"They're training now?" Most said.
"We are too," Beth told him, drawing a groan from Hudson. "No slacking. You can have all the natural talent in the world, but dedication is what makes you the best."
At her command, the others joined Jason and Humphrey. Not all of them were able to transition to a meditative state right after the battle, but at the very least, they worked on clearing their minds. Caught up in meditation, Jason was shaken out of it by a feeling of pressure in his body. He got up and staggered to the sandstone wall, using it to support him as a wave of weakness overtook him. He started coughing up gelatinous phlegm into the sand, speckled with blood. Then a blue-gray light started shining out of him, and his body surged with strength. Ability, hemorrhage, blood, has reached iron 0, 100%. Ability, hemorrhage, blood, has reached iron 1, 00%. All blood essence abilities have reached iron 1. Linked attribute, power, has increased from iron 0 to iron 1. Progress to bronze rank, 2.5%. 2 of 4 essences complete. Jason pushed himself off the wall, feeling slightly dizzy. He noticed the others had all broken their meditations and stood up. They were looking at him with smiling faces.
"The first attribute bump is a little rough, isn't it?" Beth asked.
Jason nodded, uncharacteristically silent.
"Congratulations," Humphrey said,
giving Jason a slap on the back that almost sent him sprawling into the sand.
"You've taken your first step," Beth said,
giving him a pat on the arm.
"Welcome to the path to bronze rank."
Chapter 91 Life and Death. Jason let out a contented sigh.
"This is nice," he said, then picked up a sandwich and bit into it.
The picnic at the island's park district had plenty of people. Danielle Geller was at a picnic table, which she was sharing with Thalia Mercer, Rufus, and Vincent. Jory was sitting at another table with Clive and the brother-sister pair of Rick and Phoebe Geller. Gary was sitting in a folding chair with a sandwich the length of Jason's arm.
"You know you could cut that into smaller pieces, right?" Farah asked him.
"Then it wouldn't be an enormous sandwich," Gary said. "It would just be a bunch of sandwiches."
Cassandra was sitting next to Jason on a blanket. Humphrey and Gabrielle had their own blanket, like Jason and Cassandra, but Humphrey kept shooting nervous glances at his mother, watching over them.
"Feels like it's been all work and no play lately," Jason said. "Sand pirates, underground lairs, sand pirates again."
"There's been a little play," Cassandra said, lips curving in a tantalizing arc.
"You are a beacon of luminous delight in a dark sea of obligation," he said, and gave her a gentle kiss.
"See," Gabrielle said. "It isn't that hard."
Humphrey looked nervously at his mother again.
Rufus stood up from his position at the picnic table, raising up a glass.
"Here's to our iron rankers and the first bronze rank monster," he said. "Not to mention two racial power evolutions."
As the others raised their glasses, Jason smiled, Humphrey looked embarrassed, and Clive looked surprised to be involved at all.
"Jason," Rufus said, "you've come a long way from the confused, half-naked man we met in a basement in a cannibal's cage."
"You say that like we weren't in cages too," Gary interjected.
"Thank you, Gary," Rufus said, then turned back to Jason. "Even then, you were something special. Something strange, certainly, but also special. Some of us wouldn't be here if it weren't for your actions that day. Now, look at you. Taking down bronze rank monsters, terrorizing Danielle's poor trainees. We're all adventurers here, I think, rather good ones. You may have come to us from very far away, but you belong here, just as much as any of us."
Jason rubbed a hand over his mouth, misty-eyed. He got to his feet, glass in hand, and looked over the assemblage of friends.
"Thank you, Rufus," he said. "Thank you all. I'm a stranger in a strange land, and I know I can be difficult, even at the best of times. You've all helped me, guided me, taught me, challenged me, put up with me more often than not."
"No kidding," Farrah called out.
"Quiet, you," Jason admonished.
"I'd just like to express how grateful I am to all of you. I've built a better life here in months than I did in my old world in years, and I have all of you to thank for that. I couldn't ask for better people to be stuck down a hole with, which is lucky, because I recently was." He raised his glass. "Here's to all of you."
"That's right,"
Gary yelled out, hoisting a goblet the size of Jason's head.
"We're pretty great."
"You haven't regaled us with a story of fighting the Marsh Hydra yet," Farrah said. "By the time we got back from our own contract, Cassandra had already whisked you away."
"Fair enough," Jason said. "Clive, Humphrey, get over here. We have a tale to tell." They left out the part about the skill books. Jason suspected it intersected with the confidential mission that brought Rufus, Gary, and Farrah to Greenstone, and after some consideration, asked Humphrey and Clive to stay quiet. He decided not to put the adventurers in a position where they had to ask Jason to stop investigating, although it was Clive doing the actual investigating. At the end of the tale, Jason pulled out the item they had looted from the Hydra. It was a bronze rank five-tailed whip with biting mouths at the end of each tail. The whip tails seemed to have a life of their own, waving madly and snapping at people as Gary waved it around. Jason had handed it over to demonstrate, as he couldn't use bronze rank items himself. Humphrey had his own news. He had been promoted to 2-star, which drew another round of toasting. By this point, people were starting to get woozy, especially with Gary trying to get people to toast to day drinking. Even Jason was in his cups, sharing the same bronze rank liquor as his friends to get past his resistances.
"Why didn't we all get awakening stones?"
Jason asked Vincent, the only Adventure Society official present.
"Killing that Hydra was super hard. It almost ate my boy Hump."
"As a rule," Vincent said, "we don't give out awakening stones to people for killing monsters above their rank. It would just incentivize people getting themselves killed trying to jump ranks."
"That's right," Rufus said. "Jumping ranks isn't something to take lightly. A good adventurer should be able to jump ranks, but only against the right monster."
"Don't tell them that," Vincent scolded.
"I think I should give it a try," Rick said.
"This is exactly what I'm talking about,"
Vincent said. Iron rankers rushing off to their deaths.
I'll do it in the Mirage Chamber, Rick said, getting unsteadily to his feet.
Come on, Jason, you can come too.
Sit back down, Danielle told him. How many times do I have to tell you children about using the Mirage Chamber while drunk?
I'm fine, Rick said, unconvincingly.
Such a lightweight, Phoebe said, shaking her head at her brother. The Mirage Chamber is booked today anyway, Danielle said. The Bronze Rankers are practicing sandy terrain encounters.
They have a whole desert for that, Rick complained.
The drink continued to flow, and the conversation roamed. The wiser Iron Rankers went easy on the drinks to catch any loose-lipped reveals from the Bronze and Silver Rankers.
A committee? Danielle was saying. All Silver Rankers who spent decades buying up monster cores while they sat on their backsides. Thalia, do you remember when we were the age of these kids? Crazed we were, knocking out contracts faster than they could post them. Now they're all sitting around like fonts of wisdom, deciding what to do about pirates that they never would have gone out to catch in the first place.
Your mum seems to like the sauce hump, Jason said.
She can get a bit boisterous when father isn't around, Humphrey said.
Or when he is, for that matter.
Hump takes after his father, Phoebe said to Jason. His dad is the straight line to his mum's squiggles, kind of like Hump is for you.
There you go, Hump, Jason said, throwing an arm around Humphrey's broad shoulders. Jeez, you're a biggin.
Please stop saying Hump.
Later, Rufus addressed all the Iron Rankers in a group.
Don't go rushing off to fill all your Awakening Stone slots. There's an opportunity coming up. I can't tell you about it, but in about a month there will be a... thing.
What kind of thing? Jason asked. Rufus drunkenly frowned at Jason.
It's a thing. Shut up.
Drink and the soporific afternoon sun left most of the group aggressively lounging. Jason and Cassandra were laid out on a blanket with Humphrey and Gabrielle on another next to them.
It sounds like your problem is the butter, Jason said to Gabrielle. You want to take it out of the cooler box and let it stand for 15 minutes, no more, no less. Oh, and get a stand mixer instead of creaming it by hand. You can get good ones from Artifice Association.
Maybe you can show me, Gabrielle asked.
Sure, Jason said. Madame Landry gives me free run of the kitchen, and learning about biscuits is very important. There's this whole country where I come from that calls scones biscuits. They're all lunatics.
The memorial service for the lost adventurer was held at the Adventure Society campus. The mausoleum occupied a portion of the campus abutting the north shore of the island. The shore of the artificial island was raised up from the water, with lawns seeded atop. The service was held overlooking the water. The adventurer's remains had been cremated before the service and were stored in an urn kept by the family. The adventurer's badge was presented to them by Humphrey, while the tracking stone they had followed to his remains was ceremonially placed within the Hall of Fallen Heroes. The mausoleum held not the remains of adventurers, but the stones held by the Adventure Society that marked their lives and service. Jason and Clive stood by solemnly throughout the service. After it was done, the family thanked them for bringing their son home. It was widely known what Humphrey, Clive, and Jason had faced to do so, and they were looked on with respect. They were invited to a private gathering, but Humphrey had warned them that it was correct etiquette to be asked and correct etiquette to respectfully decline. The gathered adventurers made their way to a bar where they took part in a traditional adventurer wake. It was an informal ceremony where a drink was shared in silence to the fallen. Then a drink each was taken to Humphrey, Jason, and Clive for bringing them home. Then those who knew the dead adventurer shared stories as the mood shifted from mourning to a celebration of life. The adventurer was not from a famous family or well known for his accomplishments. Many were grateful that someone as well known as Humphrey was willing to go out and find their friend. Even if the Adventure Society didn't have rules against sending an adventurer's friends and family to retrieve their body, they all knew they would have fallen too.
Jason discovered even he was building something of a reputation among adventurers. It was no match for Humphrey's, but he took many a respectful handshake and offered drink. As the night grew late, Humphrey, Jason, and Clive left with most of the adventurers, only the dead man's closest friends remaining. The island streets were brightly lit by street lamps as they walked side by side in silence. Chapter 92. Unusual Contract. The Adventure Society campus was an unusual bustle of activity as Jason made his way to the jobs hall. It was normal to see people wandering about, but there was a preponderance of society officials moving about in a hurried fashion. The marshalling yard was normally an open space where groups would meet up, but it was now covered in tents and surrounded by temporary fencing. Outside the jobs hall, he found a notice that the marshalling yard was temporarily off-limits. It directed teams and expeditions to use the space in front of the administration building to assemble. As he was reading the notice, he felt a familiar aura, turning to spot Beth Cavendish approaching.
"Quite the debacle, isn't it?"
she said, nodding at the notice.
"Do you know what it's all about?" Jason asked.
"I'm assuming this is something to do with all those tribesmen we captured. Did your uncle let anything slip?" The silver rank leader of the expedition had been Beth's uncle, Jason discovered. He was the one who had defeated the Ustai chief and accepted the surrender of their leadership.
"The Adventure Society wants to find out why the Ustai came south in the first place, then put them on their barge and send them back," Beth said. "It isn't going smoothly."
"They don't want to go back?"
"No," Beth said. "And Uncle Ephraim won't say why. What he did tell me was that if I did pick anything up, I should keep it to myself, to prevent any potential unrest, is what he said."
"That sounds serious."
"What he did tell me is the other problems the Ustai have caused. For one thing, they take their defeat and surrender seriously. They're claiming that their war barge and everything in it belongs to Uncle Ephraim now."
"Is that a problem?"
"It is, once you realize that includes all the women, children, and slaves," Beth said. "We didn't fight our way high enough to find where they were all chained up."
"Slaves," Jason said. "That's never a good sign. Wait, they want to give up all the tribe's women? Won't the tribe die out?"
"It's their culture, apparently. The idea is that now they have to go raiding for more women."
Jason shook his head. "It just keeps getting worse."
"You're right about that. Remember I said they don't want to go north?"
"Yeah."
"They want to go east. The nomad tribes follow a circuit around the northern oases. The eastern desert isn't as harsh as the north, and there are more oases."
"With towns and villages around them, not to mention everything in the delta they would chew through to get there," Jason said. "Do they seriously expect us to unleash a literal horde of men looking to kidnap women and slaves on a bunch of small, isolated populations?"
"It's their way,
and they say we should kill them or let them be." "I'm all for freedom," Jason said, "but that does not include the freedom to take people as slaves."
"You know they hit up one of the coastal villages the day before we attacked?"
"I didn't hear about that."
"Those villagers make a living from fishing and collecting water quintessence. The raiders rely on water quintessence for survival in the desert, so they raided a village. Losing food and quintessence is one thing, but they took all the people."
"We got them back, right?"
"The ones who survived. Nasty business."
"What are they going to do with all these tribesmen?" Jason asked. "Doesn't sound like we can let them go, but we can't just lock them all in a prison somewhere."
"I have no idea what they're going to do with them," Beth said.
"Someone floated the idea of taking the Ustai men as slaves, which would at least be something they understood." "That's insane," Jason said, face creasing with anger. "Slavery isn't allowed here, is it? Have I been seeing people and not realizing they're slaves?"
"We don't have slaves," Beth said. "We have indentured servants. A lot of criminals are sentenced to indenture, then their indenture is sold or auctioned to recoup the cost of their crimes."
"You sell criminals?"
"What do they do with them where you come from?"
We lock them in boxes for years and treat them like animals, Jason said, then shook his head. I think we both need better systems.
You don't need to worry about taking the Ustaya slaves, at least, Beth said. The idea died completely when someone pointed out that the Ustai wouldn't accept it. Their culture doesn't allow warriors to be made slaves. For them, capture means release or death. It's the only thing they're willing to accept.
They aren't talking about executing the whole tribe, are they?
I'm not sure. Uncle Ephraim was only willing to tell me the ideas they've already rejected.
It sounds like an absolute mess, Jason said, then tapped a finger on the notice. Which I guess it is. Admin must be a madhouse, with every team assembling on their front steps.
They went into the jobs hall and checked at the front desk. Since neither had any assigned contracts waiting, they went to the notice boards. They were both two-star adventurers, so they went to the same one.
You'd be after the big-ticket items, with a whole team behind you, right? Jason asked, as they perused the notices.
That's right, Beth said. Mostly I'm after something that can push the team, but also something that still pays out well, split four ways. Fortunately, they tend to be the same jobs. You work mostly solo?
Yeah, but I've been picking up some group work here and there, Jason said. I've worked with Humphrey Geller a bit, and a friend from the Magic Society.
Jason plucked a notice off the board, frowning at it.
Find something good?
Something interesting, Jason said. It reads like a one-star mission, but it's two stars.
Probably means it was a one-star, but some complication cropped up. Once a couple of people try and fail, they kick it up. They tend to be annoying contracts, so most of us avoid them.
I'm more about learning things the hard way. I'll see you around, Beth.
She sent him off with a wave and a smile, turning back to the notices as Jason took his to the front desk. It was listed as a straightforward monster hunt for a monster called a Furgax. Jason looked it up on his monster archive tablet. It was listed as a highly aggressive, bear-like creature. High strength, moderate speed and fortitude, no exotic abilities.
Morning, Bert, Jason greeted Albert at the contract registry desk.
Good morning, Mr. Asano, Albert said. Quite the kerfuffle we have going on today.
So I've seen, Jason said. I don't suppose you heard anything about it?
Oh, I'm a bit low on the ladder to know about that, Mr. Asano, Albert said. I imagine you'd know more than I. Weren't you part of that expedition out in the desert?
I was, Jason said. They didn't tell us grunts much, which I'm realizing isn't something I'm comfortable with. I'll need to be more judicious in what I'm willing to participate in.
Albert nodded at the notice in Jason's hands.
Speaking of choosing contracts, Mr. Asano, he said, what have you got there?
Jason handed over the notice.
Can you tell me why this one is two stars?
Albert gave it a glance.
Ah, I know this one, he said. It's a bit of an unusual contract. Do you know anything about the Furgax, Mr. Asano?
Just what's in the Magic Society archive.
Well, there isn't much else to a Furgax, Albert said. Simple creatures, not too bright. Very aggressive, which makes them easy to find. Usually they spawn in the driest parts of the Delta, where it's actually possible to grow some lumber-worthy trees.
That'd make it some of the most valuable land in the Delta, right?
Indeed it would, sir, Albert said. People get real fastidious when it comes to land rights out there. Most times the laws are whatever the richest person nearby says they are. But the land rights for the lumber region are heavily regulated. What's different about this contract?
There's a fellow who owns a lumber mill out there, Albert said. Been around long enough to know a Furgax when he spots one. Every time we send someone out there, though, no Furgax. No deaths, no damage, which is pretty much how you track a Furgax. The mill owner has registered a sighting 8 times in 3 months, even pushed a nice incentive on it. People keep taking the contract, going out, and not finding a thing. It's reached the point where the society is about ready to black mark him.
Black mark?
That means he won't be able to register contracts.
I can't imagine that would be good for someone who relies on land out in the Delta.
I don't imagine so. Might even be legal repercussions with those regulations I mentioned. Couldn't say for certain, with it not really being my area.
Jason frowned, thoughtfully.
Whose area is it?
Bert thought it over for a moment.
I guess that would be the folks at the Civic Records Hall.
Thanks, Bert.
Put me down for the contract. I'm taking it.
Jason didn't immediately set out for the Delta. His first stop was the Civic Authority Records Hall and Library in the Guild District. After paying a small fee for access and a moderate bribe for assistance, he found what he was after. As he was about to leave, he turned to his bribed functionary.
"Oh, and miss?" he said. "Do be sure not to tell anyone that I was here, or what I was here for. Only you and I know that, so if I find out that someone else knows, I'll know it was you."
He walked right up to her, pushing down on her aura with his own. She stood there, shivering slightly as he leaned forwards to whisper in her ear.
"Doesn't matter who you tell, because they can't protect you from me. The Mercer family can shield you if I try to get you censured for having loose lips. But that isn't what's going to happen. One day, all your colleagues here will wonder why you didn't turn up. Your family will wonder where you've gone, but they'll never find out. Do you know why?"
"Because you've killed me?"
"I doubt you have any idea what my powers do, so I'll explain the portions that are relevant to you. First, your body will die. Not of anything. It'll just stop being alive. Then, I'll suck all the moisture out of your corpse. I'm not sure if you're aware, but life force is a beautiful, vibrant red. I'll be taking any that your body has left, which will dry out your remains nicely. Then I'll collect you in a cask. Not a big one, because there won't be much of you left. But I have a dimensional storage space, so it's fine either way. Whatever remnants there are, I'll clean off the floor with crystal wash. Are you familiar with it? Marvelous stuff, but hard to afford if you're not making adventurer money. Suffice to say, it will clean up any residual stains of what used to be your body. Then, on my next trip out to the Delta, I'll scatter what's left of you scoop by scoop into the bogs and marshes, until your final resting place is just sticky patches of mud."
He stepped back, flashing her a friendly smile.
"So, let's just make it our little secret, yes?"
"Absolutely not," Clive said.
Jason had found him in the chaos of his disorganized study.
"It's for a contract," Jason said.
"I don't care if it's for the God of Generosity," Clive said. "Those records are anonymous, and they stay anonymous. Even Lucian Lamprey wouldn't violate that, and he's as rotten as three-week meat."
"Who?"
"Lucian Lamprey," Clive said. "Branch director of the Magic Society here in Greenstone."
"Never met the man. I guess I shouldn't complain about your reticence. I should applaud integrity wherever I can find it."
"There's no telling if we would have a record of the power you're looking for anyway," Clive said. "Not everyone records their powers with the Magic Society."
"Fair enough," Jason said.
"What about a ritual that shows me if a summoning was used in an area?"
"A regular essence ability summoning?" Clive said. "I can do you one better. How does a ritual sound that not only shows what was summoned, but takes an aura imprint of the summoner and puts it on a tracking stone? You'd need to be right on the site of the summoning, and within maybe half a day of the summoning, though."
"Clive, I could kiss you."
"Please don't."
"How about this?" Jason said. "If you can't tell me who has the ability, can you tell me everything the Magic Society has about an ability?"
"I could," Clive said. "But why would I bother? Don't you have the magic tablet that can access all the Magic Society's public records on powers? You know we sell them, right?"
"Oh, yeah," Jason said. The same list that showed restricted essences had records on everything the Magic Society knew about individual powers. Jason looked up the power he was interested in on his tablet.
"Standard salt circle," he read.
"No worries. Hunt me up a copy of that tracking ritual, Clive, and I'll be out of your hair."
"Why would you be in my hair?"
Clive asked, as he started looking through bookshelves.
"It's just a saying," Jason said. "It means I'm tangled up in your business in an annoying manner."
"You don't need hair for that," Clive said. "You have a natural talent."
"Harsh,"
Jason said with a wince. "Did you hear anything about what's coming next after capturing all those sand pirates?" Clive asked, still looking for a copy of the ritual.
"Not much," Jason said. "Apparently everything is under wraps until they figure out what to do next."
"Well, I hope they don't need as many drivers, whatever they do," Clive said. "I've been trying to figure out who that ancient complex belonged to. As I thought, I've been cut out of the investigation in favour of Lamprey's favourites. Of course, the skill books we extricated may have slipped my mind."
Jason chuckled. "How's that going?"
"It's odd," Clive said. "It's like there's a whatever it is I'm looking for shaped hole in the historical records, as if someone went through and purged it. I'm putting a puzzle together by connecting around the outside, working in, until I'm left with a gap the same shape as the weird piece I started with."
"I love puzzles," Jason said. "Farah had me doing speed runs as mental training."
"I like them too," Clive said. "Do you have one of the magic sets where the picture and the pieces change? Back when I was studying to join the Magic Society, we'd get drunk and try to solve them."
"Oh, we're definitely doing that," Jason said. "Hey, you should talk to Gabrielle about the missing knowledge thing. You know, Humphrey's lady friend."
"The Acolyte of Knowledge," Clive said. "That's a good idea. Destroying knowledge is the biggest sin they have. Can you pass me the book on that table?"
Jason took a book out from under a potted plant and handed it to Clive.
"I'm fairly certain that ritual is in here," Clive said, flipping through it. "I'll make you a copy, and you can be on your way."
"Finding high salt content," Jory said.
"Yeah, I have something for that. Come with me."
Jason followed Jory into his new storeroom, practically an alchemical warehouse. "With the clinic closed all week for the final renovations," Jory said, "things have been completely mad. The big reopening is in a couple of days. Will you be in town?"
"Not sure," Jason said. "I have this contract and I'm not sure how long it'll take."
"You know, you're the one who made all this possible," Jory said, gesturing to the building around him. "It'd be nice to thank you publicly."
"On second thought," Jason said, "I'm pretty sure that contract will keep me out in the Delta. I'd rather be a silent partner. Thank you very much."
"I'm not sure that works, with you healing sick people with your magic powers for months. But sure." Jory took a bamboo watering canister down off a shelf and gave it a shake. "Should be about 4 cubic meters of water in there."
"A dimensional bag watering can?"
Jory chuckled. "Just clean it out and top it off before giving it back," he said. "Those things aren't cheap."
"Will do."
Jory opened a cabinet, taking out a large glass bottle with a teal liquid inside. He tipped half the bottle into the watering canister before putting the bottle back. Then he took out a small vial of liquid, before handing the vial and the canister to Jason. He gave Jason the instructions to use, clean, and refill the canister.
"Not sure what you're up to," Jory said. "But good luck."
Chapter 93 Truth. The lumber region was on the south side of the river, in the eastern parts of the Delta, furthest from the city. Jason had been refining his long-distance running style that employed the weight-reducing power of his cloak. It was really more like a series of floating, horizontal hops over whatever surface he was crossing, be it land or water. He'd been through enough of the Delta that he had most of it mapped out, and he could save time by taking direct routes instead of following the embankment roads. He could walk on water and teleport past obstacles, so while he might not match the speed of airboat travel, his straight-line navigation outpaced an ordinary mount. It required occasional replenishment from mana and stamina potions, but Jory's low-cost options were easily worth it. Their moderate effects might not have the kick required for intense combat, but they were perfect for Jason's travel needs. The days were growing shorter as summer moved into autumn, and the sun had just set as Jason arrived in the town of Lust. It was one of the largest and richest towns in the Delta, with paved roads and stone instead of mud brick for buildings. Mostly it was the cheaper yellow desert stone, but there were greenstone buildings as well. The interior coolness produced by the water affinity of greenstone was appreciated by everyone who could afford it.
In the muggy heat of the Delta, it was often the difference between a good night's rest and a sweaty, sleepless night. For that reason, Jason selected a large greenstone inn to stay the night. Pausing outside the door, Jason stopped to put on his game face. His posture shifted and tightened, face and shoulders both scrunched up in annoyance. He threw open the door and marched inside, face full of aggravation. Striding across the room, he parked himself angrily on a barstool. "Drink," he demanded of the barman. "Best you have, and same for food after." The barman reached for a bottle of amber spirits behind the bar. "Not that bitter crap," Jason said. "Do you have any Norwich Blue?"
Yes, sir. We use it to make blue juice jumpers."
"Blue juice jumpers?"
"It's a mixed drink, sir, but..."
The barman leaned in close.
"Usually we serve it to our female patrons."
"If someone has a problem with what I'm drinking, then I'll be happy to clean them off my sword." Jason was in full adventuring gear, weapons at his hip, and a bandolier of throwing darts on his torso. He turned and took in the busy common room at a glance, no one willing to meet his gaze. "That's what I thought," he said, turning back to the bar.
"If I may ask, sir,"
the barman said as he made the drink,
"are you an adventurer?"
"That's what the badge says," Jason grumbled. "Some bloody adventure they've sent me on, though. Do you know how many people they sent out before me after this imaginary frigging monster? 8. I'm the 9th, and I'll be the last one way or another. You can believe that. If this monster isn't out here this time, I'll personally see to it that the prick sending out these notices gets black marked. A Fergax that doesn't kill anyone or break anything. What a load of crap."
"That would be the Lindover Lumber Mill you'll be heading out to, then?"
the barman asked. "Probably," Jason said. "They gave me a map. I don't care what the place is bloody well called." Jason had trouble grumbling through what turned out to be a delicious drink and a quite excellent dinner. But he did it anyway, resisting his normal urge to seek out the recipe. He retired angrily to his room, performing a simple ritual to shield himself from surveillance magic before dropping the act. The next morning he left the inn as irritably as he arrived and set out for the lumber mills. The lumber region was more solid ground than marsh, like most of the Delta, but not dry and hard or dead and empty like the desert. It was like walking through a forestry reserve, with straight, earthen roads passing between trees lined up in neat rows. Sometimes it was akin to a natural, if neatly arranged, forest. Other times he was walking past a sea of saplings, or the devastation of a recently deforested field. Wagons went past on a regular basis, wheeling loads of lumber to Loost. Jason passed several large wooden archways, with signage declaring the name of the lumber mill the road behind them led to. When he reached the one labelled Lindover, he walked through it. He followed the road through the trees to a large lumber mill, but it was still and devoid of people. Jason kept going past the mill and up to a sizable farmhouse. Knocking on the door, he was met by the most lumberjack-looking man Jason had ever seen, and they made introductions. Kyle Lindover was a Leonid even larger than Gary, with a red plaid shirt, tough worker's pants, and huge thick boots. He looked like he could knock down trees simply by punching them. "If I was a tree and saw you coming my way," Jason said, "I think I'd just surrender." "Do you like pressing wildflowers?"
"No," Kyle said. "Why do you ask?"
"Just something I heard about lumberjacks." Kyle showed Jason around. Kyle had shut down the mill after the repeated Fergax sightings, not wanting his workers to get hurt. His business was lucrative enough to sustain the downtime for a while, but his reserves were falling short, and most of his workers had taken up with other operations, having their own families to feed.
"My wife and kids are staying with her parents in Greenstone," Kyle said. "I've been maintaining things here, but every time I look at starting back up, the monster appears again. I keep getting adventurers out here, but they don't find anything. I'm afraid I'm going to be black-marked."
"We'll have to see what we can do about that. I'd like to start by seeing all the places the monster was spotted." Kyle did exactly as asked, taking Jason all around the property. There was the lumber mill, the farmhouse, and a dormitory for people working the mill. There was also a small farm producing food for Kyle, his family, and the workers.
Kyle was doing his best to keep everything in order, but he was clearly getting overwhelmed. Jason said he wanted to look around for himself, leaving Kyle to go back to the farmhouse. Jason made his way around the property until his map ability had fully unveiled everything. Afterwards, he sat down with Kyle at the farmhouse, enjoying some fruit punch Kyle had made while Jason was roaming about.
"This is really good," Jason said. "Can I get the recipe?"
Looking over his map, Jason marked out the areas the Fergax had been spotted. He could just tap a finger to the map and set a marker, or drag his finger to mark a whole zone. Kyle watched curiously as, from his perspective, Jason was waggling his finger in empty air.
"Invisible magic map," Jason told him, not looking up.
"I figured it was something of the like."
As he examined the map, the general area the monster was coming from was quite clear. Jason marked out a grid pattern to search, then left the farmhouse to get to work. He took out the watering can Jory lent him, complete with extra-dimensional water storage, and started sprinkling it over the area marked on his map. Kyle looked on with curiosity.
"What exactly are you doing?"
"Looking for salt," Jason said. He kept moving from spot to spot, sprinkling little bits of water as he went.
"Salt?"
"That's right," Jason said. "When you use an essence ability to summon a monster, the first step is to make a summoning circle. It isn't complicated, but you do need to use the right material. I have some friends who use obsidian dust and iron filings, but exotic materials like that are generally for the fancy summons. Most people just need a circle of good old salt, including people who summon a Fergax. I'm betting the summoner just kicked it into the dirt after, rather than collect it up."
"You think someone is summoning the monster?"
"I do."
"You think someone is trying to drive me off my land?"
"I do." Kyle hung his head.
"Why us?"
he wondered. "You're independent," Jason said. "You don't have a backer in Greenstone to push back with."
"How am I meant to prove what's going on?"
"You're not. I am. Adventure Society at your service."
"I've had the Adventure Society out here before," Kyle said. "How are you going to prove any of what you're talking about? We don't even know who's behind it."
"Sure we do," Jason said.